Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Josh Brown, a Sonic game has scored 76 on Metacritic at the time we record this.
Listen, the thing is,
in 2022.
Right, the thing is, Sonic Frontiers is getting very good reviews for a Sonic game.
Yeah.
But I almost wish it hadn't, because I don't want you to be disappointed, because now you are looking at that green Metacritic score.
Green Hill Zone, baby. It,
I know what you're thinking. You're getting wild ideas about what this game is going to be. You're going to over-egg it and be disappointed. I wish it had scored in the 60s, and then you would have been pleasantly surprised, because I don't want you to get ahead of yourself, Scott.
I played Sonic Frontiers when we were at EGX, and I really enjoyed it. So I can't see where it can go wrong. I'm going to play it at midnight. We didn't get access to a review code, sadly, but I'm going to dive on at midnight. And little me can't be disappointed at this stage.
I don't know if that's true. I've seen you.
I like Gotham Knights.
This is the thing.
Yeah.
You're going through, and I say this as a friend. An episode over the past week or so with Scorn, with
I'm a
Gotham
full series,
Knights.
Brother.
You certainly are. Someone's ordered a second season
pass
of the Scott Telford show, because some of the things that you've been coming out with and talking about about video games, which we're going to get into on this podcast, have been. Well, they've been something, all right.
Hey, look, Sonic Frontiers is something, all right. In fact, it's a better something, all right, than Sonic's been in about 11 years. The last game to have a green score on Metacritic was Sonic Generations in 2011.
What I love is that last night, I think it was, you put out your top 10 games of the year so far. And
personal
now
picks.
You're going to have to rejig that.
Well,
Sonic
I deliberately
Frontiers.
Did that. I wanted to have it. It's like big BC. What is that? What's that religious thing where it's like AD and BC?
That's it. That's the one.
I want to do that.
Like, for Sonic.
Yeah. AS and BS. I needed to say my bisecting point in the year is before Sonic Frontiers and after Sonic Frontiers. But yes, I should say this is the wind up. I'm Scott Tilford. You're Josh Brown.
Good afternoon, Scott Tilford.
Good afternoon, good evening, and good night. We usually do this podcast a bit earlier, but we couldn't get in the damn studio to get stuff recorded. We had too much content to do.
Things have been going on,
including Sonic Frontiers, but we wind up for the week with whatever the latest talking points in the industry are and whatever the latest news is. But for the latter, there's nothing going on. The industry is very much winding down for Christmas, and we've got a little bit of a news thing to talk about in regards to the PlayStation VR 2 getting a confirmed price.
Yeah, it did.
And it's ludicrous, but we'll get there in good time. We're not going to talk about Sonic that much because I haven't played it yet, but I thought we'd sort of just do a roundup. You've been playing God of War Ragnarok. We've both been playing Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2. In Ragnarok's case, the review and a Q&A video is online. Tips and Tricks will be online for the release day, which I think is on Wednesday.
Yes.
Ridiculous that it's out
which
on Wednesday.
Which is nuts, by the way. I did not prepare for that at all, and I should have, because, as you said, I've been playing this game. Thankfully, Sony sent us two copies.
Yes.
You've, of course, taken the brunt of the content, done the main review, like you've said, done the Ask the Reviewer, and I know you have a lot more juicy content coming out for Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday as well, including a Tips and Tricks video.
Can I tell
the people about that?
That's what I just said, Tips and Tricks on the
did
old
you really?
Today.
Yeah. God, it's so late in the day.
It's 4 p.m.
I'm already blanked that. I heard Ask the Reviewer, my friend. I'm so sorry I missed the rest of that sentence. But yes.
It is okay.
So overall, I'm not going to say too much about God of War Ragnarok, because I'm only 10 hours in,
yes.
And I want to avoid spoilers or even the potential of spoilers at all costs. but I will say that friendship ended with Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2. Because now God of War Ragnarok is my best friend. I am really enjoying this game, Scott, and you know, like we said, we're recording this in the afternoon, and normally I wouldn't actually mind if a recording of the podcast went past five because I enjoy doing these so much. However, today this podcast is shutting down at 4:59. Ooh. I'm going to pack my stuff away and I'm going to run home to play more of this game because, yes, I'm really enjoying what I've played so far. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend people check out your review for your much larger thoughts. And we will dive in more come release date and into next week, no doubt.
Yes. I don't know if you had the same kind of feeling as you're playing through it. And like you said, you're about 10 hours-ish in. I finished it about 28 hours in. And that wasn't 100% playthrough. But it's such a hard game to review. There's so many points that you either can't talk about or don't want to talk about because you want to prioritize the experience for new players. So it's one of those things that I get it's the big talking point, but I think it'll be a much bigger talking point in the coming weeks. I'm so curious what people think of the various things that are in here, even within the first sort of 10 hours or so. So we'll kind of skip past that. I guess general closing thoughts at this stage.
Well, at this stage...
Or you pick whatever you want. You want to talk about more stuff? Bring it on.
No, where I'm at right now, I can confidently say that this is definitely a sequel to 2018's God of War. And you feel that in every way. However, I will say, again, without spoiling anything, it has already thrown so many surprises my way in terms of the narrative, in terms of the level design, in terms of the gameplay, that I was hooked from the opening. I think this opens, arguably, in my opinion, in a stronger way than 2018's did, and gives me personally, or has given me, more narrative push, more gameplay push than 2018 did in the early hours. And because of that, I'm very thankful. And because of that, I'm kind of in immediately. Not that I wouldn't have been anyway, because it's a God of War sequel, but I feel like, to me, this is a more propulsive game.
We talked a lot before we started recording about the various things that it gets right and the changes in the overall feel of the narrative and how, like, 2018's God of War is like a much smaller story. It's just sort of Kratos and Atreus trying to spread some ashes and you climb up to a mountain and things get in the way and no one will just let this boy spread some ashes, and it just kind of goes from there and various things happen. Whereas this is a much, much bigger thing about prophecies and fitting into them and how can you defy fate and all that kind of stuff. It's much bigger, which is, you know, there are ideas that God of War has tackled in the past, and it's like I said, it feels like a much grander tale, and it's like, yeah, I think we're gonna move on because I feel like Ragnarok, people are so tetchy about spoilers, and you should be, that I feel like a lot of people will just kind of, it's everyone's like clenching, just don't say anything that will give anything away, and I'm, oh my God, have I stressed out about that for the last 2 weeks.
You have no idea, everyone listening to this, how bad I have been in this office, because anytime Scott even uttered the word God and of and war in the same sentence, I practically,
left the room
and had to hush you because I didn't even want to know the tiniest thing. So I fully get anyone listening to this who might even right now be like, whoa, I don't want to know anything. Yeah. But incredibly, we're 2 days away from launch and we get to talk about this game properly over the next week. And like you said, I can only echo it. I'm so excited to see what people think about the developments in the story, how the gameplay has evolved, all of that jazz. Talking to you this morning about it and talking to you now about it on mic, I forgot how much I missed the shared experience of like everyone going through a big game together. Yeah. Obviously, we had that with Elden Ring, but that
wasn't the last time this year, though.
100%. And that wasn't even as story focused as this. No. You know, this is where we're going to be dissecting characters, you know, direction, plot points, way more than we did with Elden Ring. It's a whole other beast. But I forgot how much I missed that when we were talking about intricacies of certain scenes and how they played out.
Totally.
Like, that's what I love. That's what I'm excited to do next week. And that's what I'm excited to see other people do online and hopefully tweet us about it as well.
Yeah, we'll do. I think from here on out, because we've got the God of War review, we've got the Ask the Reviewer, they are both 100% spoiler free. There is a Tips and Tricks that will be spoiler free as well. And then after that, I think it'll be straight on spoiler discussions, etc., etc. So, you've kind of got like a nice 3 set of videos to get dove into and then get stuck into the game, get through it, see what you think, and then come back and you can join us for all the spoiler stuff, because that's the most interesting stuff by far. That's the kind of story and the kind of thematics and everything that I just can't wait to speak to people about it. And there's one thing that sucks about reviewing video games, it is that isolation. meditating feeling of just kind of being in like a bathysphere. I love that word. Waiting for the rest of the world to sort of like get in there and so you can talk to them.
You've literally been that meme, you know, where it's the guy at the party and it's like, they don't know I've completed God of War Ragnarok. They don't know I know the story of God of War Ragnarok. That's been you at this office for like 3 weeks.
Oh my God, dude. I mean, like, yeah, if we ever did a podcast about why reviewing games sucks, that would be my number one thing, is that you don't have the shared experience.
But yes. Thank you, Sony, for sending those cards.
Yeah, massive thank you. Absolutely love having the codes. Love the Ragnarok. It's a big thing. But in regards to conversation, I'm a big fan of the old banter. But anyway, yeah. Speaking of banter, Scorn is my number three game of the year.
See, this is...
Personally.
Ooh, you know what? I'm going to let you talk about this because you texted me last night saying, Josh, I think Scorn might be my game of the year.
I love it.
And I think
I put
my phone down and continued playing God of War because I couldn't process it.
And you went, he's doing it again.
And when he's doing it again, here's the thing. I really liked Scorn. I talked about it on the podcast a few weeks ago.
You did.
I thought it was really good. In fact, I think I like certain levels of it more than you, in fact.
Mm.
So can you tell me why this has instantly shot up your rankings? Because you've played a lot of games this year.
True. Oh my God, have I.
Marks this out as being special.
I think, well, one, obviously it's the immediate stuff. It's the art direction. I think it has, as much as it is borrowing from H.R. Giger stuff. And I should have looked up the name of the dude. There's another guy that does H.R. Giger style artwork. I think he's another Polish guy. And it's very like that. It's very like dissolute and like warped and sort of like, you know, everything looks kind of disgusting. Everything has flesh to it. Everything's this biomechanical push. And I feel like a lot of people looked at Scorn and just went like, oh, is that an alien game? And then when it wasn't, they went, I don't want anything to do with it. But once you dive into it, I feel like it has this overall identity that sort of looks like H.R. Giger inspired. It's not directly trying to be like Alien. It's just pulling from the same source material or the same sort of reference points that I guess he had when he was designing the Xenomorph or something. And for me, it's just, it has so much confidence in its depiction. And it's this like, this really like completely effed up like, horror scenario where you're like, you're this kind of prisoner, you're this sort of human or humanoid thing who just wakes up in this facility and you're just interacting with the various puzzles and this sort of, you're just exploring this place, trying to figure out what the hell's going on. Who are you? What's going on? What do I have to do to get out of this place? And I just feel like it just has such an atmosphere that is just so incredibly effective. Like nothing else looks like it in gaming history. I mean, really, it doesn't. Like overall, like you can point to H.R. Giger inspired stuff.
Yeah.
And you can point to the likes of like Myst as being this sort of like disparate approach to puzzling, puzzle levels or whatever. But I just feel like it comes together so well. And then by the time you get to the end, some of the really visceral imagery that you're getting and some of the themes that they're exploring, which I guess I'm not going to give away because it would be spoilers, I guess. But I just feel like it's just such a immaculate piece of fiction. I just got so lost in it and it was so effective. And I just think about it all the time. I feel like its visuals are just so memorable. I feel like it has just such a punch to it. The combat is absolute dog, which is one thing.
I do agree that it is an effective game. Like I think it's
massively
really good, really memorable. And I think it's way better than a lot of people are giving it credit for. Like sometimes you kind of mention Scorn and people get scorned by it. It's like some people hate this game and I can't quite fathom that because for me, the puzzles are, after the first one, which is a bit of a roadblock, the puzzles are relatively straightforward, I would say. And that's not me being a big-brained,
smart
guy. Mm-hmm. I think the way that the game ushers you around the levels is relatively straightforward. Mm-hmm. And the checkpoints aren't great, admittedly, but I don't think it's a game you necessarily get stuck in, but it's a vibe, man. Like, it's an experience, it's a journey, it's atmospheric, and it's kind of like just something to get swallowed up by, ironically.
If you like sci-fi horror, space horror, something like John Carpenter's The Thing, unquantifiable horror, then and just getting lost in it and not knowing the rules of what is after you or what's really going on or whatever, atmospheric horror, it's that. And I think it's that specific feel. That's why I love The Thing. It's one of my favorite films of all time. And it's just, like I said, it's an unquantifiable horror. And I feel like they, even by the end of the game, you don't really know what role you played in this whole facility and what's really going on. You can point to certain things. And I love the interpretational side of it too. Like I have my own read on it that just makes it even more spooky and cool.
Yeah.
And I just kind of love that. So it's those things. It's sort of planting those seeds. And it's got this like this really like tactile feel to it where everything is like leaden and you're sort of like pulling these big levers or interacting with all these like dead parts of this factory or whatever the hell this place is that you're inside. And there's just so evocative. I think the whole thing is just so, so evocative. And it feels like someone used to live here, or someone used to work here. And am I someone, who, like, as the character, it's like, did I used to work here? Is that why I'm waking up here? What the hell's going on?
Yeah.
And I just feel like they just nail that whole feel of, like, I don't know what's going on, but I'm going to figure it out. And it just has this, like, survivalist edge. But to quickly address, you were saying that whole idea of, like, some people absolutely hate it, is so mismarketed. Like,
right.
I mean, when it was first revealed, like, it has the fact that it was revealed as an Xbox exclusive. Everyone thought it was an Alien game because they showed the part of one of the designs, I think it's on one of the murals in the game, that looks like a Xenomorph head. And when it was revealed to be Scorn, and then some people saw that it was first person, it was, oh, it's going to be a first person shooter, it's going to be an action thing. It's not. Like, you know, you get a couple of weapons in it, one of which I completely missed. You can get a pistol near the beginning, apparently. I didn't get that. But you do get a shotgun, you get a grenade launcher at one point. Which, again, sounds more action-y than it is, but it's a first-person puzzle game. It's more like The Witness. It's more like Myst. Like, and it's about getting lost in a space and understanding 3D space and the satisfaction of slowly, incrementally getting through something. It's also really short, which I think made people go like, oh my God, an Xbox exclusive and it's only like 3 hours.
Mm.
But for me, it does not stay its welcome. It's perfect. It's perfectly made.
I think as well, without, you know, spoiling anything about the later stages of the game, but those later stages
are so good.
Yeah, the final area, I fully agree, is like one of the best levels of the whole year so far. Like you were saying, I can only echo the words that you've mentioned, you know, so evocative, so memorable, so impactful, so otherworldly in its design.
And so effed up. It's so, so effed up.
Dude, this game is so gnarly, man. Like, the gore in it, like, even outside of just everything you interact with in this game is made of flesh, like the weapons, the health packs, the enemies, yourself.
Sorry, I'm very passionate about this game. I'm just thinking, to not give away what the specifics are, there is a squishing machine in this game. And what you squish in that machine, I would not have seen coming until I was doing the squishing.
Not at all. I remember getting to that bit late at night, you know, in thinking, well, this is...
I'm doing this,
I guess. The game is making me do this. This is...
All animated very, very well. Like, an entire team of people had to perfect those squishes.
Yep.
Like, it's a whole thing.
Speaking of the squishes, though, in terms of its sonic footprint, like the audio design of the game, you know, absolutely supports those fleshy, wet visuals that you're seeing.
Wet visuals.
Wet visuals, I know.
Soaking.
I'm thinking of the, you know, when you see, like, the Xenomorph in Alien 2, especially,
it drips a lot.
Dripping with goo. I get the same vibe in a lot of the levels here, you know, whether that's blood or whether it's goo or whether it's the bodily fluids.
There's always like Geiger. Something dripping, or there's like just weird torn flesh hanging off everything. It's like the entire facility has this veneer of like having been alive at one point or whatever the hell it is. Everything is bony, everything is fleshy, everything is pulsating and breathing. I just, for me, it's so, so effective. And I just kept saying out loud every 5 minutes, like, oh my effing God, I love this so much.
Not to drop you in it, though, because I do want to talk about the game's flaws, because I wouldn't say it is necessarily a fully recommendable game. Because
it's very hard to recommend it. Yeah.
That's it. There are moments, I know, when you got to some combat areas and you were messaging me, like, annoyed and thinking, well, is it even worth pushing on if this is going to be the rest of the game?
Well, because that's the thing, because they hide. For me, they hide the first weapon you get. I have no idea where that is. I didn't get a pistol. I got this weird weapon that is pretty much a Xenomorph's head gun.
Yes.
Which is just like it's like a cattle prod. You're sort of like pointing at its stuff and a little part of it juts out and goes back in again. You can only do 2 shots before it has to, has like a cooldown of about 20 seconds. And in by that point, you'll have just been killed. You die in like 2 hits.
Yeah.
You have a health thing you eventually find, which you sort of inject it into your wrist to get some health back, but the amount of health that you take away if you get hit by something is enough to kill you in about 2 or 3 hits. And a lot of the enemies do projectile attacks, which they can still kill you even if you're trying to solve a puzzle or you're interacting with the health thing. It's very Alien Isolation of just like, oh, I'm trying to save, or I'm trying to do something, and I've just been gored through the stomach by something. The combat side of it, until you find the ranged weapons, is pretty cumbersome and awkward and pretty awful in that regard. And also, if you die, the game's checkpointing only banks checkpoints when you solve puzzles or meaningfully interact with something. So that entire time you're figuring a puzzle out, it's nothing is banked. And if you die before you get to the next major quote-unquote story bit, you could lose like 10, 15 minutes. Like, and that really, really sucks, especially when one of the biggest positives is just exploring the place and just enjoying the art design, only to come around a corner and for something to spit on you and then die and then go all the way back again. Like, that was the stuff where I was like, oh my God, this fundamentally clashes with what you're trying to sell me. But holistically, especially when you get to that final area, it's like, okay, I get what that area was. I get how that works.
Yeah.
It's awkward, it's cumbersome, the checkpointing absolutely sucks. But it does give that area of combat a bit more personality, a bit more memorability in the overall journey that you go on as this whatever the hell you are from the very beginning of the story.
Yeah, I think I would agree. You know, as a level, that one specifically, where it does feel like a combat gauntlet combined with this, you know, incredibly dense exploration section where there's a lot of enemies, there's a lot of puzzles to solve. It's kind of like, pick one or the other and give me an easier time. But ultimately, you know, and I think it's an interesting way to talk about games, because how much leeway can we cut them if an experience, a frustrating experience like that, whether intentionally frustrating or not, ultimately contributes to the thematics that are at the heart of the story?
Like, I do think it's bad. Like, I think those parts are like, let's just say objectively bad. Like,
yes.
Yeah, but that stuff sucks.
How much slack are we willing to cut it if, in retrospect, it makes sense that we had so many frustrating moments?
It's like one of those
level.
Things where you could say to someone, it's worth pushing through.
Yeah.
Like, it's like knowing that the final area is so rewarding and sort of gives you the answers that you want for so long. And they're not like, they are kind of spelled out. I feel like it has a very, for me, it has a very specific takeaway. And I get that the overall thing is interpretational, but I got to that final area and looked at the murals and the various other things that it was showing me visually. And I was like, okay, this is so cool. Like, I really like the overall world that you're presenting here. But yeah, that is definitely a low point, especially when it succeeds so well at environmental and puzzles and everything else beforehand. But that's another thing, is that they choose to put a really roadblocky puzzle right at the beginning, where it is quite cumbersome. You're just sort of moving parts around on a board in the distance to try and solve like a weird, it's like a bubble style puzzle. It's like sets of two that you're all sort of putting next to each other, or Puyo Puyo rather. It's kind of like that. It's like a Puyo Puyo thing, which I don't know if you're a Puyo Puyo fan.
I'm not.
But it's very much like a Puyo puzzle, and which was kind of popped me, because I was like, that's funny that there's a random Puyo Puyo puzzle thing in here.
Well,
like set lining up sets of two everywhere.
Let me ask you a question. What
ask
was
me a question.
More frustrating? That first puzzle in Scorn or the bit in Gotham Knights where they make you do Sudoku?
That bit in Scorn, because I was just like, oh my God, let me get through this. And that bit in Gotham Knights where the whole, like, you're searching down the Court of Owls. I'm not going to do plot spoilers, but like the whole setup of that game is, oh my God, the Court of Owls live underneath Gotham. We need to find them. And the fact that one dude who has all the answers has a giant like wall that goes into the ground, but it only opens if you can solve a Sudoku puzzle. Like, literally, it's a Sudoku puzzle. Like, that was hilariously dumb.
What I loved about that, not to make it all about this puzzle, but I loved that the game literally stops to teach you Sudoku.
I know.
You don't know.
Well, the thing that doesn't make any sense is that you go to that wall and it looks like a Sudoku grid. It's like a 3x3 or something. Maybe a 4x4, actually. And then you're sort of looking at it, it's a bunch of symbols, and then I was playing as Jason Todd, so he was just like, what the hell's this? And then Alfred gets on the comms, and Alfred's like, oh, I love Sudoku. And then they just run with the fact that it's Sudoku, and it's like, I thought you were making a visual comparison, Alfred, but
no.
You're actually just going like, no, I know exactly what this is. Like, okay, yeah, sure, I guess we do this all the time.
Amazing, what a strange game that is.
Game of the year. But in regards to Scorn, also game of the year, I feel like that's the thing, it's like completely personally, I feel like Scorn was just so wall-to-wall impressive. Like, even when I was getting killed, I was just annoyed because I wanted to drink it in more. I wanted to just keep going. And I feel like the combat stuff was just infuriating in that specific section. It's about, it's only like a 3-hour game anyway, if that. And it's about a half an hour stint at about the 2/3 mark.
I love that this game did live up to what you hoped it would be, because you started Scorn, obviously. Then you went on to Gotham Knights.
Yep.
Then you went to Ragnarok.
Yep.
And then you went to Mario and Rabbids. You've had a long journey to get back to Scorn, is what I'm saying. And you got back, and then ultimately it proved worth waiting.
Scorn
was
the one,
great.
As soon as I started it, I just think overall it's so immediate. The art direction is so powerful that even as soon as you load it up, it's like, oh, I've never seen anything like this before. It's so well rendered and everything. Scorn was the game that I was gutted and really like quite sad that I had to, quote unquote, prioritize Ragnarok over. I was always looking forward to getting back to Scorn.
Right.
And so as soon as Ragnarok was done, dove back into Scorn and absolutely loved it.
It's interesting though, because, you know, we're obviously talking a lot about the design of it. And you just said there, you know, it's like nothing you've ever seen before.
No.
My issue with the game, and it's not really an issue. It's literally baked into the entire construction of the game, is that I have seen those visuals before in, like, H.I. Giger's art in the Alien series. I've never seen it.
I mean, in games. Like, that's what I'm saying. It's not been done in games.
Yeah, I've never seen it, like, done like this in a video game, but it wowed me, but it couldn't reach a deeper level because its influences were so obvious, whereas like I viewed it as like almost a beautiful recreation of something rather than its own new thing. And it's hard. It's like I'm criticizing it to a point where, you know, I'm saying a bloody 8 out of 10 game is only a 8.1 out of 10 or something. You know, I'm talking like fractions of love for it. But it's just, I think that's why I didn't connect with it as much as you did, because I was still blown away by the visuals, but I was kind of so aware of it, its influences, that I couldn't really connect with it.
The thing is, like, I feel like there is, obviously the go-to is H.R. Giger. Like I said, again, because in that trailer, it was like, well, that's a Xenomorph head. And like, there is something in the game that looks like a Xenomorph head. But I feel like, because my wife showed me, there's a, I've just got to Google this dude's name. I'll probably end up, well, I will say this wrong. But there's a Polish painter called Zdzisław Beksiński. Definitely not how you say his name, but that dude's work is very much in the same vein as H.R. Giger, but a lot more sort of like depictions of humanity and skulls and skeletons and that kind of thing. And there's also it reminded me of Tool's album art, which I think I said when I started playing it.
Yeah.
But I feel like there is a wider sort of exploration of depictions of humans or humanoid stuff that isn't just H.R. Giger. So I feel like, to me, it's like, yeah, you can go, that's definitely a go-to. But when I was playing through Scorn, I felt like it wasn't just that. I felt like it had a lot more to it. I felt like this overall, just this messed up environment that I've not been so grossed out by a depiction of something since I think the original Oddworld. And we did talk about that, the original on PS1. But I just, for me, it's an overall like confident punch. It has such a graphical punch, a sound punch. It's so like interactive and you get so lost in it. I just think it's super, super effective.
Yeah, play Scorn. Scorn is really good.
Go check out Scorn. Just don't expect to be shooting lots of stuff. Don't expect alien stuff. Just expect one hell of a effed up horror experience that is just creepy and gross and dripping.
And wet.
It's very, very wet. Speaking of things that are wet, not a segue at all whatsoever, but Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2.
I don't think I like that. What
I don't
you
think
just
I like
there.
That at all.
No.
Modern wet work. They do wet work in the campaign.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's the one.
Easy. Half past 4 p.m. But in regards to that game, we're just going to talk a little bit about Call of Duty because I feel like this year was a good COD. This is the best COD since 2019. And this is the most that I've played a COD since 2019.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
teen as well.
I feel like when I was on the podcast last Monday, I was a little naive about the changes that were made, in all honesty, because I came on and I was kind of complaining about things that you should complain about, like the spawns in the new perk system and whatnot. But I also lumped in the new loadout system with all of those negatives that I had. And I was wrong, Scott Elford, because the new loadout system, the new progression system is incredible, in my opinion, and has transformed the way I usually approach COD multiplayer. So, just to explain, if you haven't played COD in a while, or if you're new to Call of Duty, in the old games, it was mostly the progression and your unlocks for your creator class was just based around leveling up either specific weapons or your whole character. So if you went to, say, level 14 by getting kills or winning matches or whatever, you would eventually unlock an M4. And then if you wanted all the attachments and all the camos for that M4, you would just use the M4 in games. You would unlock all of the attachments that way by getting kills, by leveling up that specific gun. But this time around, they have changed it. So you still get some weapons by leveling up regularly in gameplay. However, others are actually variants of weapons that you've already unlocked. So there are, you know, a bunch of different AK variants in the game.
Yes.
You have your classic one that just works like an AK-47. You have one that is like an AK-74U, etc., etc. And to unlock those guns, you have to spend time with the first AK, to unlock the second AK, to unlock the third AK. But they've also changed camos and attachments. And bear with me, I promise this is worth it. They've also changed camos and attachments. So if I want to unlock everything for the AK, every attachment for the AK, I can't just use that gun. I have to go and use something else. I have to use a gun that I might not usually use, maybe in a completely different class, to unlock everything for it. And that might sound stupid and cumbersome, because why would I want to use another gun if I want to use this gun? But it's made me use weapons that I would never normally use in a Call of Duty game. It's
the Breath of the Wild approach.
It's the Breath of the Wild approach. It's made me spend time with player styles that I wouldn't usually adopt, and I'm having so much more fun now that the game has enforced that variety. I know that you don't necessarily agree.
No, I do. I just everything excellent you just laid out, I don't see it. I can't. I've tried so much to see it. It's like someone opening a book in front of me and being, look at all the words on this. And all I can see is just paper. I can't see it at all. I play Call of Duty every year. I have done for, I don't know how long now, 15 years?
15 years.
Whatever it is. I mean, I was playing it before Modern Warfare, but that was definitely the one that sort of locked stuff in. I guess that'd be 14 years. 15 years. 15 years. But for this one, it feels immaculate. The thing that I really love about it is just how immediate it is, which is why I love Modern Warfare 2. Why I love Modern Warfare 2, the 1.
Very good.
I love Modern Warfare 1, 2. You know what I mean? TWO. But that whole thing, I feel like just, like, because you were saying about this whole weapon variety thing, how that's encouraging you to try different approaches and everything. And I was just like, I'm holding the left trigger and then pushing the right trigger with my starting M4. And I'm coming first. Like, I'm doing really well, so why would I change things up? And then I was like, well, I'm getting dominated by this one single-shot rifle thing that everyone seems to have right now. So I was like, oh, screw it, I'll switch things up. So I started using a shotgun, which I know is blasphemous in the Call of Duty community, but I had a lovely time with the shotgun. And I started mixing things up, and I did kind of tap into how satisfying a variety of approaches is in this game engine, or with all the tweaks they've made to the ways all the different firearms feel. So I'm still very much a casual Call of Duty fan, and I play all of them. I'm going to play through the campaign and everything. But I want to get more stuck into the stuff that you described, like this idea of like various treadmills that all kind of feed into each other. I really, really cannot genuinely pass that. Like they keep trying to tell me, hey, hit triangle to view the weapon map thing. I can't get it. I don't know what it is. I brought it up the other night again because you broke it all down for me in person and said, well, you're like, this is the starter weapon on the left, and then it's like there's different options that you could go to, but I can't tell how to spec towards any of them.
Yeah.
So I just keep playing, and I'm just playing, and playing is lovely, but I cannot figure that game out.
Well, this is it. The UI sucks, man. The UI
is bad.
Is a travesty across the board. And
what's a worse UI, God of War Ragnarok or Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2?
Has to be Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2. Because at least God of War Ragnarok doesn't let me jump into multiplayer and then think I'm in a lobby when I'm not in a lobby. So I'm wasting like 10 minutes at a time. But not the point. Yeah, the UI sucks. I totally get, you know, a lot of this just being far more obtuse and obfuscated than it ever should be, because there's a great system there. They just need to communicate it better and to streamline it better and to make it clear what you're working towards and what you are unlocking. Because they had that stuff nailed down in Modern Warfare 2019, which we talked about last week, but they just don't seem to have that level here. To go to a positive, though, I do think what's great about the variety of the weapons and how it pushes you to indulge in that variety is that each weapon this time around, Scott Tailford, is actually viable. So right. many times you get a Call of Duty and the meta is established right from the get-go. You want to use this gun with this perk, with this secondary or whatever, and then you stick with that this time around. Almost every weapon I've used feels viable in a gunfight, you know, whether that is the M4, whether it is the 74U, which absolutely slaps, whether it is that SPR rifle that you're getting rinsed with, or whether it's, you know, the MP5 equivalent, whether it's this, whether it's that, everyone I've used feels good to use, and it doesn't feel like I'm just, like, you know, handicapping myself in these games because I'm going to get rinsed by a laser-powered M4 that has five attachments that everyone's using. It just makes for more variety in each game, and to me, that's more exciting.
I might tweet this out because everything you describe, I believe you, and I wish I felt that. I feel like, you know, in Spinal Tap when that guy reels off a bunch of stuff and he just, Nigel Tufnell just looks at him and he's like, this one goes to 11. I feel like I'm just going to go, I'm going to use the M4.
Well, the beauty is, right?
My M4 has a laser on it.
Here's the thing.
I shoot the men with it.
I'm sure it does. I hate that. Why would you put a laser on the gun?
Everyone, what do you mean? I want to see where it's going to shoot.
Everyone can see where you're shooting from.
But I kill them. You can't kill me.
There you go.
Yeah.
What I was going to say was that this is what I love about the new Call of Duty, though, is that it if you don't want to care about that stuff, you don't have to.
No.
You can jump in with the M4 and still have a lot of fun because the core gameplay is incredibly satisfying just on its own. But if you were ever kind of interested in changing up your playstyle, if you were ever one of those people who wanted to level up every gun in Modern Warfare because you wanted to have options for Warzone by the time that meta came around, you're going to have way more fun this time around doing it.
Yes.
Because it's almost being created with that kind of progression in mind this time.
No, totally. Sorry. I know this will make you laugh die inside, but I don't have any interest in playing Warzone or Ground War or anything other than free-for-all, team deathmatch, domination, or kill confirmed.
Well,
I tried Ground War in, was it Modern Warfare when they brought that in?
Yeah.
And I was like, this is Call of Duty, not Battlefield. I don't need this. I don't need this in my life.
Well, that's a nice segue because Ground War is really good in this game. It's really good. It's kind of beaten Battlefield at its own game, man. Like, I still liked Battlefield 2042. I was checking my playtime on it last night.
Right.
I've got 70 hours in that game.
Good Lord.
And I do still enjoy dipping back into it. I had fun. It's not great.
Wait a minute. You got 70 hours in Warzone already?
No, in
Ground War.
And that's an old Battlefield, man. That was in Battlefield. I've got 30 hours in Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 so far.
Okay.
But the point was that I still enjoyed that game enough, but obviously it had issues. Obviously it's nowhere near as good as it could have been. In Ground War in Modern Warfare 2 just does everything that Battlefield should be doing, bar the destruction.
Right.
Just does it better, man. Like that kind of large-scale, all-out warfare, capture these points gameplay with your squads, with these really cool weapons, with these really cool vehicles. It just does it so well. And for me, I know that you're not necessarily into that style of gameplay, but if you are, this is kind of catering to Battlefield fans who felt like they were burnt with 2042. You know what I mean? It's like, come over here. Like, we're doing it better. We're doing it better than the competition. Come on, come over. We've got everything you could want. If you want 6v6, we got this. If you want these large-scale 32 versus 32 matches, we got them as well. We've got 2v2s coming in a few weeks' time. We've got Warzone
vehicles.
after that.
We got it all.
Yeah, we got DMZ coming as well. We've got every mode you could possibly want. And you know what? It's pretty good. I don't like to gush about Call of Duty necessarily because it's Call of Duty, but like you said at the start of this section, it's a good one. It's a real good
one. I feel like every year it's sort of like, I think I said this in the last podcast, but it's like we till the fields, we check the harvest, and it's like this year's good COD. It's good COD. give it a sniff. It's good COD. I feel like every year we take a different whiff, but this is a good COD.
I will say this. I'm saying it's a good COD. I ain't even touched the campaign.
No,
I haven't touched Spec Ops. Two-thirds of this game.
Spec Ops, never going to touch that.
Not interacted with, but the multiplayer, that's good COD.
The four maps I've been on, very good.
The four maps you've been on.
With the one gun.
The one gun and the three game modes you play.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, I can't get enough of that.
You need to get off free for all, man. That's the one I take real umbrage with. Do whatever else. I mean, live your life. Do whatever you want. Do whatever makes you fun. It makes you happy. But to me, free for all is like, I couldn't imagine.
He's folding his arms.
I couldn't imagine having fun playing Free For All whatsoever, man.
No, because it's fun. It depends what map you're on. But if you come around the corner and there's two or three boys shooting each other, I'll just mop you all up in one go with my starting M4, and it's a good feel.
I don't know how I can't. I'm going to leave that there. Let me know. You guys out there listening to this.
I'm not saying I'm picking nebulous. It over the others. Team Deathmatch is still where it's at, but I like Kill Confirmed a lot as well.
He's the thing. Don't get me started on Team Deathmatch as well.
What do you mean?
I think I mentioned in this podcast before. I've definitely mentioned somewhere because I've annoyed myself with saying it so many times, but I'm over Team Deathmatch in games. I need something more, especially in Call of Duty.
You want tickets to Countdown.
Like you said, too. Like you said, we've had 15 years of this, right? I've had 15 years of COD Team Deathmatch. I need something a little bit more dynamic.
I definitely do not. I just want lots of people on the Shipyard map, which I think they teased, or maybe it was Charlie Intel did a tweet saying Shipyard's coming soon or something like that.
They'll put it back in.
They better put it back in. Just give me a tiny little field that's got barbed wire on the outside and a container in the middle, and I'll play sight lines around that all day long.
You're like that rat pushing the pleasure button until it died. Put me on shipment, put me on Free For All. Let me press the left trigger, right trigger. Yeah, that, it's dead.
That rat brain that was hooked up to like a set of wheels, yes, and it just sort of drives around, but it has no idea, but it's getting somewhere. Yeah, that's very much me. That new map, though, to round off the COD stuff, that map that's set on the highway that everyone hates because the cars randomly blow up.
Oh, it rules.
I love that map. Yeah. I feel like, give me more gimmick maps in Call of Duty. Like, I love that London one that's in 2019's Modern Warfare, and with all the sight lines and the buses in the middle. And then this one, it's like you can just play a game of sight lines, and you're just shooting dudes through windows and cars.
I was howling playing it yesterday, man, because I like that map when all the cars have exploded. It's like genuinely a really good map, I think. But yesterday, I just got off to a good start on it, right? I threw a grenade because there was a guy genuinely there. It wasn't just
As soon as I spawn in, I'm throwing a grenade.
Well, he was a thing. Killed him. Mm-hmm. And then I got a few more kills and got one of those like Predator missiles very quickly. Used that to get a kill. Mm. But because I'd used so many explosives, I'd set the fires to a bunch of different cars. And then, no joke, for the next 5 minutes, it was like an explosion in the distance. And it was like plus 100 XP.
Oh, really?
An explosion in the distance, plus 100 XP. And they kept dying via these exploded cars for about 5 minutes afterwards. I evacuated the whole enemy team. There were two people left by the time all of those cars had exploded, because I imagine they were just frustrated with the fact that they were next to these death machines every single time.
I've definitely seen a lot of compilations of people just loading in and blowing up next to a car, loading in, blowing up, because there's no marker saying that it's about to blow up. You just die, which must be infuriating. But that's a cool little tip and trick the game doesn't tell you, that the XP is sort of like carried on based on whoever started the fire, let's say, and it kind of goes from there. I like that as an overall thing. Let's talk about a news thing, which is the PlayStation VR 2 is going to be retailing for £530 / $550. Let me remind you that a PlayStation 5 is £360 or $400 for the discless version, or £450 or $490 for a disc version. So the PlayStation VR 2 is more expensive than a PlayStation 5.
To be expected, Scott Tilford. Not nice news to get, admittedly. No. I didn't expect it to be £529 in the UK.
Half a granny.
It's very pricey. We're in a cost of living crisis. Mm. Can I afford it? No. Will I buy it? Yes. Like, I'm looking forward to this.
Life finds a way.
So much. Life will find a way. I'll have to do a lot of saving, scrimping and saving over the next few months.
PlayStation 5.
But I think anyone who was expecting this to be drastically less than a PS5 just kind of doesn't quite understand
how... in the VR space.
Yeah, that's a polite way to say it. Doesn't really get that these things cost so much money. And to get the specs that you're getting in the PSVR 2, like, this is competitively priced. Mm. You don't have to like that price. I'm not saying you have to go out and buy it and save up £500. Of course not. Mm-hmm. But in the VR space, I think it was to be expected. Of course it's expensive, but for the power in the box, I do think it's competitively priced. It's going to be worthwhile, I think, if you're into that stuff. If you're not, then do not. I do not recommend going out and buy it. But if
I have realized that your Sonic the Hedgehog is PSVR 2.
God, you might be right.
Yeah. Just if you're into it, it's pretty good. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense to anyone else, but the people in that space are loving it.
That's so right as well. Oh, you've got me.
And you're sort of like aware of the sickness.
That's it.
Yeah, that's what it's like being a Sonic fan.
This is it, man. Like, I mean, with this price, you know, I think it would have been negated. One, if obviously the PlayStation 5 wasn't still so scarce and wasn't priced so significantly lower. Mm. And two, if the PSVR 2 actually had some good games coming out at launch, and I know there are some nice ones in there that I'm eager to play, like I'm really excited to play Pistol Whip, the next-gen port of that, and a few others, but
There's not much.
No, I'd want a big first-party game there at launch. You know, something that will sell the console is like, look at this original big AAA thing that will justify dropping half a granny on this new bit of kit. And I think it's very much going to be for enthusiasts again, for better or worse. Hopefully the games do come because the tech there is, like I say, like really impressive.
I do think it's kind of interesting just almost throwing your hands up and admitting defeat of just like, we're not going to get the mainstream audience in. All we can do is compete within a certain space and be one of the best VR headsets out there, because I'm not going to get this. It's just, and I'm just not that bothered. I tried PSVR, didn't really sell me on the medium overall. I just guess I'm still waiting for specific titles. But even the things that they've shown for Horizon Call of the Mountain, like that just looks like another on-rail shooter or another first-person shooter thing, whatever the hell it is. If so far, I've not seen any gameplay where I've just gone, that's an incredible way to interact with something that I couldn't possibly do on a controller. And I guess we'll wait and see what else the first-party teams come up with and everything. But yeah, the idea of putting the DualSense tech in there is really cool, because the idea of all the different haptic feedback and everything, whatever, like there's different ways to feel more immersed in games. But the thing that I think also kills it for me is that it still isn't wireless.
Right.
I just, like, if we're going to do this VR future, that's the whole thing. It's like, are we already past the accepted answer to, is VR the future of gaming? Is the answer just no, and we're just moving forward? I don't know, but like, it's interesting, that idea of like, if the answer was going to be yes, then it needs to be as accessible as unlocking a Switch or a phone or whatever, putting your PlayStation back on, instantly diving into something, or just thinking like, oh, I'll play the VR mode of this, and grabbing your headset off the shelf and just putting it on and it just works. It still hasn't got there yet, and it won't with this either.
What I would say is, of course, we've come a long way, but if you look back to when regular consoles were viewed as the future, they were still a little bit cumbersome. You still had wired controllers. You still had a bunch of adapters.
In the 90s?
Yeah, I'm talking PlayStation 1 era, let's say. You still had wired controllers. You still had these things that you would have had to put up with at the time. And yes, in the console space, we've iterated and we've evolved so much where we have got it down to the bare minimum. You have the console under your television. Mm. You have two wires in the back, let's say, and you have your wireless controller. VR will get there. VR is getting there now. You do have wireless headsets. And for me, one wire shouldn't be that much of a barrier to entry. I get that it's not ideal, but it's one wire, you know what I mean? And this time around...
this is the sickness talking.
And this is why I'm more lenient on the price as well, because you get the controllers in the box. If you priced up the PSVR 1, which obviously I had to do when I was buying it, you know, it was 300-ish for the actual machine. Then it was 80 quid for the Move controllers on top of that. Then it was another 50 quid for the PlayStation camera that you needed. So it totted up to like, you were looking at 450 quid all in if you wanted the best experience. Mm-hmm. And to me, that tech didn't quite justify that price. So to add another 50, 70 pounds on top of that to get the specs we're getting, the discrepancy isn't quite as much as it appears, I don't think.
No, I think like comparatively, like this is going to be way more worth the money than PSVR 1. I mean, PSVR 1 was like this weird MacGyver, what have we got left in the garage style, throw it together thing, whereas all the motion controllers from when they try to rival the Wii, using them as controller ones and everything. I feel like that's the thing. Like on like the actual price, what it's being applied to is, I'm sure, very solid for a VR headset. I mean, it looks like they're trying to rival the Vive or like the most recent Oculus models and stuff, which is really sweet. But I just, overall, I just feel like they've almost, it's not admitting defeat, it's just knowing your market. Like people who are into VR are going to be very psyched by this. And I guess it's not necessarily priced competitively, because you can get like 350, 400 pound Oculus models of the new ones. You can get the wireless ones. Quest 2?
That's true, yes.
But the thing that they are trying to compete with is giving you a Valve-style experience. And if the likes of Half-Life Alyx can run on this, as the various rumors seem to point to, then that's a major win for, like, overall in the VR space.
Yeah.
But, like, it's interesting. I feel like they know their market at this point, and they're just sort of like, we know what you guys are going to respond to in terms of a VR thing, and they're not necessarily bothered about getting the... like, your average person isn't going to end up with a PSVR 2.
I think they will eventually, but they're definitely not going to be at launch. At launch, it's going to be for enthusiasts. Hopefully, that spreads word of mouth. Hopefully, the machine is actually good. You know, I'm just kind of taking that as a foregone conclusion based on what I've seen. And then when it does inevitably come down in price, hopefully that's when people can enter and the more casual consumer won't look at it and say, well, that's more expensive than a PS5. Mm. What am I getting? What's going on? Because, you know, the PSVR 1 eventually did drop in price, and this one will too. So I think, yeah, exactly right. At launch, it's going to be exactly what you said. It's going to be for a specific audience. But I do genuinely believe that when it does fall down in price, when hopefully we get out this horrible cost of living crisis and it becomes more viable, then more casual fans or maybe people who aren't necessarily sold on the tech will be able to jump in without fear.
The call of the mountain.
They will hear
They'll
the call of the mountain.
Down the hills.
They will be like, is that Walking Dead Saints and Sinners 2 on Josh Brown's top 10 of 2023 list? I think it is. I'll have to play that.
I think it's about time for Firewall 0 Hour.
I can't wait for that, man.
Whatever that thing was. I feel as well that PlayStation's marketing, or just the general approach of like how do various companies market VR, has come along quite a long way in the last few years. And where even like the PlayStation VR, it was like, how the hell do you show this off to people? Because the general consensus around VR was like, you need to go to a shop, you need to go to a store and try it yourself. And it's obviously a terrible marketing tactic because you just can't do that. It's like saying you should go see the movie after you've seen the movie yourself. It's like, yeah, it needs a trailer, it needs something else. And I feel like general marketing around VR is good. Like, even the way they advertise the DualSense, the way that they'll try and show what a feeling is, the way that they show when they were showing Horizon Forbidden West off with the DualSense, and it'll show like a bowstring being pulled taut, and that's like mimicked with how like tight the trigger is, and you let go of the release of it and everything. And with PSVR, it was like the first person Robert Downey Jr. Iron Man cam. And it's like, while you're like this, this is what you're seeing, and then trying to map those things together, just trying to convey what it's like.
Yeah.
I think that's their biggest hurdle to me. Because I gave in and bought a PlayStation VR when No Man's Sky got its VR update, because I'm not going to play whatever No Man's Sky's doing, and I wanted to see, but that is absolutely not the average person. So I'm curious what the PSVR 2's rollout will be. Because the backlash to the price wasn't that big. I mean, a lot of people just went, yeah, of course, it's a high-end VR headset or whatever, but I'm still curious, like I said, where they want it to sit. How wide do they want to go? They're getting a Horizon exclusive on here. Like, that's really, really cool. That'll turn heads.
Yeah.
But whether it actually offers something that doesn't feel like it could be done on a controller is a whole other thing.
I think it will. You know, this is based on gut feelings and the specs alone and what I've played on the PSVR 1, which, like you said, is so rudimentary, slapped together in some guy's shed, probably, that I do believe it will. But this is going to be a constant Scott and Josh conversation,
it
I
might
think.
Be.
I'll be like, it's the future. You'll be like, well, I can do that on a controller.
That was my thing on the PSVR 1. It was just that idea of, like, nearly everything is an on-rails first-person shooter. And I just don't care.
You know what's funny?
Go on.
They announced, as a launch title, a spiritual successor to Until Dawn, Rush of Blood.
They did.
Which is an on-rail shooter,
yeah,
but it rules.
Literally on rails. Like, you're on like a roller coaster car going through a theme park. And I was like, are we just trying to be meta about this? Like,
it's so good. It's so fun.
At some point, we'll be literally shooting loot, and then that's like the way that we advance the whole conversation. But yes, for now, this has been The Wind-Up. I've been Scott Tilford. You've been Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you, and we'll catch you next week.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.